The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Coming to you cordless, everybody. It's 11:02 on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, and 10:02 where I'm sitting here in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm Jim Peters, and welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night. It's installment number 33, if I'm right, and today, October 10th, is my birthday. I turned 68 today. I am old as the fucking hills. Well, how the hell did that happen? Now, I went to dinner with some friends tonight, which was very nice, had a few people out. But it was point we were talking at the table. So now, if you listen to the show last night, I had a wonderful interview with my mother. She's 99 years old. She still lives on her own. She's still sharp as a tack. She's still a complete unbridled liberal, and she wonders what the hell happened to me. And that's fine. That's okay. But we were talking at the table. One of the people at the table is the wife of a good friend of mine. Or I should say she's actually a good friend of mine because I've known her. She grew up a few houses away from me. I've literally known this person since I was 2 or 3 years old. She's like one of the first people I ever met outside of my family, you know? So it's 68 years later, we're still sitting around a table yakking. And her mother's 93 and my mother's 99. And I was talking about how weird it is to be 68 years old and have a parent that's still alive. She was telling me that she got together with a bunch of school friends of hers, 11 people, for a little coffee clutch, and somebody asked whose parents are still alive, and she was the only one out of 11 people who had a parent who was still alive. And it is kind of odd. And the weird thing is, and Mary said this during dinner, it kind of keeps you young because your parents are still alive. It's like it's hard to, and my mother still treats me like I'm 12. Who am I kidding? You know, and she does. And I got to admit, it bugs the crap out of me. But, you know, she does. And I do wonder, though, if it just reflects on my, youthfulness or whatever you want to call it. You know, I don't know. I'm not trying to flatter myself here, but I'm still mom's little boy, and mom is still around. If mom wasn't around, I don't think I'd be mom's little boy anymore, you know? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, so tonight, Nathan Wooster, the political and energy reporter and environmental reporter from the Epoch Times, is joining us. He's in Chicago, and he might even be in Iowa. I'm not sure. I want to talk to him about that. He posted some stories today, and I think he's traveling with Trump, but I'm not sure. So we're gonna have he's on. He's our guest tonight. Because he's coming on relatively early, I don't have a lot of long monologue here tonight. He's coming on around 10:15 the Central Time, and the reason is because I got to be honest with you. Especially for people on the East Coast, this thing about interviews at 11:30 at night is not sitting that well. So we have been, the 33rd show, we've had guests for the majority of them. I'm saying probably about two dozen guests. About half of them have opted to pre-tape in the afternoon because they don't want to stay up till 12. They don't want to stay up till 11:30, 12 o'clock and do this. And I kind of don't blame them. We tried. If you've been following the show at all, and you probably haven't, we tried the last week of August. In our fourth week, we tried going up an hour, and that basically didn't help matters at all. The numbers were the same. We didn't have, the difference between people coming on at 10:30 and 11:30 was pretty much the same. Because of the infrastructure in the studio, it does help us to go an hour later. It's not necessary, but for various reasons, which we'll get into, it does help us. So we went back. So that's what we're doing. So he's a guest tonight. Jeff Meyer from Calling News is coming on Wednesday. Thursday, we're taking this Thursday off. I'm going for a long holiday weekend to the Michigan UP to see some friends. We do the same time every year, same weekend, because the colors are absolutely fantastic. I think, you know, I'm talking about the leaves on the trees, you know. And for those of you who live in Florida, you know, I went to school at the University of Miami. And I mean, I met people who had never seen snow ever. And the other thing is, and this is really true, and you can look this up on the Wikipedia. They did an article on this. I don't know the exact date. I think it's January 16th, 1977 is the only date in recorded history it snowed in Miami. It snowed a quarter of an inch of snow at 6 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, in an hour, it was all gone. It was all melted. But it did snow. The real story that day is that for Miami, it was cold as hell. So I remember I'm walking across the campus. I was a big tennis player. And I got my stupid little tennis whites on, my stupid 1970s, you know, Australian rule, football rule shorts on, the short shorts. And this woman, student, she stops me. She's wearing a mink coat. I'm on the path. I'm walking on the path, and she's going walking the other way. And she stops me, and she says, "What the hell's the matter with you?" I said, "What? What do you mean?" She says, "It's freezing out here. How can you be dressed like that?" And then before I even answered, she said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Minneapolis." And she said, "Oh," she left. Yeah, but I was there that day. It snowed 6 o'clock in the morning in Miami. Yep, there you go. So I don't, because Nathan's starting early tonight, I don't have a lot of things I want to talk about. I've saved a bunch of stuff for tomorrow night, especially when Jeff comes on. The one thing I did want to mention tonight that we did not talk about yesterday because of all the stuff going on in Israel. And like I said, because of that, there's a lot of stuff in the news that's falling through the cracks. So one of the things that almost fell through the cracks, not quite, was the fact that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced the fact that he is going to run for president as an independent. Now, I'm predicting this right now, that assuming he stays in the race till Election Day, this will cause Joe Biden to lose. He's going to get way more. You know, people say, well, you know, Republicans are going to vote for him too, and that's really true, they are, but he's going to get way more votes from Democrats than Republicans, and this will cause Biden to lose the election. I'm making that prediction right now. I don't think Biden can withstand this at all. And the thing is, Kennedy right now is polling at 19%. Last night, I couldn't remember, I had a brain fart, I couldn't remember the name of the guy I was talking about, Ross Perot, that's his name. So, and he ran for president along with the incumbent George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton in 1992. And this behooves remembering. So Ross Perot got 19% of the vote. That's the most votes a third-party candidate has ever gotten in American history. He got 19% of the vote. And Clinton won without a majority. He won with 45, or I think it was 46% of the vote. He had a plurality. He had the most votes of the three of them, but he did not have a majority. And that's when that has not happened very often in presidential politics. And it kind of, there are people that held that over his head too. It's like, you know, the majority of people didn't even vote for you. Now, you know, okay, Trump won the Electoral College in 16, but not the popular vote. But even then, I think the vote was 51-49%, I think. So I think that's what it was. I'm not sure. I mean, it was still very close. And these elections are getting razor thin, but still almost always in the last 20, 30 years since then, the winner, or one party anyway, has gotten at least a slim majority of the vote. But that didn't happen. And I'm predicting right now that Joe Biden will not survive this. He won't. Regardless of anything else that happens, I mean, the guy's polling is polling in the dumpster. But even besides that, and it does appear now that Trump is going to be the nominee, it really does. He's putting out feelers about the fact Trump has said himself that he thinks DeSantis is going to drop out. I do too, you know, and so, I don't know, we'll see. But I'm making that prediction right now, and you can stamp it, it's my birthday, the hell with you people. And yeah, and I'll play this back if I'm right or wrong, okay? Nathan Wooster's here, we're going to run the bumper, Get a load of this. Look how classy this is. Nathan, hi.
Hey, Jim. Yeah, that is a classy bumper.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I know. It's like almost professional even. You know, I've seen pictures of you. This is the first time we've actually seen each other, even though we talked before. How long have you had the beard?
Oh, gosh. You know, it was actually a lot longer, not that long ago. But I would say about, give or take 5-6 years.
I've huh, oh,
had
okay.
it on and off.
I've never seen any pictures of you with it. So, you know, it's very surprising, but you're a very handsome man. Very attractive. Yeah. All right. First of all, I don't think you were on. You were signed in when I actually mentioned this. Are you in Iowa right now?
No, I just got back.
Okay.
I was there for a 5-day trip, seeing all of the major candidates on the Republican side. So I spoke with Vivek Ramaswamy, or rather, I saw him, and I saw Trump in 2 rallies, one after the other, one in Waterloo, up at the National Cattlemen's Association or something like that,
uh-huh.
And then in Cedar Rapids. Then after that, I saw DeSantis in Cedar Rapids, saw Nikki Haley in Boone, a little town just north of Des Moines. So really taking in all of the Republicans at this point, where really it's hard to see how anyone except for Trump is going to win in this caucus. But we're really closing in on, you know, the home stretch for any of these other candidates who are hoping to distinguish themselves in a race where, at least from where I'm sitting, it's harder and harder to see a lane for them, at least in Iowa.
Now, I'm bouncing around here, so forgive me, but you were at the Democratic debate in California 2 weeks ago, right?
The Republican.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, forgive me. Yeah, the Republican debate, right, yeah. You were there, right?
Yes, and the first debate in Milwaukee.
Okay, so the second one, we did a panel discussion here, like right after the debate was done, and the feedback I got both from the panelists and from the people watching, the feedback I got is that, well, you know, you guys did a pretty good job talking about this considering the fact you had no material to work with. Everyone thought this was a snooze fest. So today, I'm trying to set up the panel for the next debate in November, and the guy I called, he said, yeah, I'm happy to do it. He said, but I hope they cancel it. That's what he said. What was your reaction being there? What did you think?
I thought it was, you're absolutely on the mark. It seemed to me as though it was the dying gasp of a medium in search of its own justification. The final question, I don't know if you caught this, asking who would you vote off the island, Chris Christie being the only person who answers, it feels like a relic from the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah.
At a time when the world demands seriousness. You know, serious people are saying we could be on the verge of World War III. We're having these incredibly significant issues with domestic policy, with our spending, with the border. And we're getting these reality show questions as though we're still living in the kind of, you know, Francis Fukuyama end of history moment when we're so obviously not. So I thought it was an embarrassing show. I thought that some of the candidates did reasonably well, some did more poorly, but, you know, everybody said this, but it's simply true. Without Trump, it's kind of hard to know why it's even happening.
Did you were guided as a basically audition for vice president?
Yes and no. I think in part it's an audition for vice president I've written a few articles about this, spoken with, you know, political scientists and people who watch these issues carefully. You have candidates like Chris Christie, Mike Pence. They're obviously not going to be vice president. I think Mike Pence's career ambitions are harder for me to fathom. I think Christie is boosting his profile in media at the very least. Maybe at some point down the line in some future administration, Republican or Democratic, he could be considered, you know, a good domestic policy person. But for the most part, those guys really do want to be president, but I think they know it's unlikely. On the other hand, you have people like Nikki Haley, for example, who I think she's not running an unserious campaign, but I think the VP slot is much more believable for her. Up until recently for Tim Scott, then for Christie, for Pence, for DeSantis.
I have a theory. I'm a conspiracy theorist, so you tell me how off the mark here. I think somebody from the opposition is actually paying Christie to run. That's what I think. His only purpose seems to be bashing Trump. That's all he's done here the entire time. And it looks suspicious to me, you know? So yeah, you can tell me I'm crazy. It's fine, but I'm just throwing that out.
I'm not going to tell you you're crazy. I would just say, you know, I'm a journalist, so I try to look for what's the information, what can I lay my hands on to specifically say that's true or false.
Right.
What I'll say is that even if you can't demonstrate that he's being paid by any particular actor, some moneyed interest, which might well be the case, you look at Christie getting, for example, that town hall on CNN where the crowd was dead silent. And you know that if it had been anybody but Christie of a comparable stature, if it had been, I don't know, like a Doug Burgum, there would not have been a town hall devoted to the guy. And Doug Burgum isn't exactly pro-Trump or anything. It's just that he's not the designated anti-Trump Republican.
So right.
I think as much as anything else, it's a way to maintain the illusion that, well, we're living in like Mitt Romney's Republican Party or something. We're living in that era. And that a person like Christie is serious because he gets to be elevated to this stature in the media that based upon his poll numbers, based upon his relevance to what's happening now. And I'm being a little bit hard on him because I think he is not, he's not unserious, but you know, in terms of this like presidential contest, he's an also ran very obviously.
Yes.
I think just being elevated in order to try to reproduce a set of artificial choices that no longer exist, that the electorate doesn't buy into at all.
Now you see, this is the reason I admire you, Nathan, is because you are a true journalist. I am not a journalist. I'm just sitting here pontificating off the top of my head. Yeah, but that said, I think we're both throwing out valid stuff for the public because you're throwing out facts and I'm just throwing out speculation. But sometimes speculation's right, you know? That's the thing. I don't know. I'm sticking up for myself, I guess, here. But seriously, I admire what you're doing. Now, I have to ask you another question based on what you said. And that is, how much of the Republican Party, at least in Washington, at least in the power structure, wants to return to the old Mitt Romney Republican Party? How many? Half?
I think, I don't know if I could give you numbers there. I would say you look at some of the people who have had positions of influence in the Senate or in the House who, you know, have to this day committee chairmanships or who are kind of closely tied into particular lobbies. And you start to see some answers. You have people who I think even if they're not super committed to the idea of displacing the Trump Republican Party, they're kind of just going to go along to get along, or uh-huh. however that expression goes. What I find interesting, I'll just say this in passing, you're talking about, you know, the old Republican Party. I think just generally, one of the things you can't help but notice when you're on the campaign trail is that there are these vested interests that go in and they insinuate themselves in particular ways. In the context of Iowa, ethanol is a huge issue there. They grow a lot of corn, lots and lots of it, more than we actually need for food or even to feed cattle. And so a lot of it goes into ethanol. I think as recently as a few years ago, up to above 50% even of Iowa's corn went to ethanol. And so I, at these multiple forums, I kept running into a person. He asked this very pointed question about, would you allow higher ethanol gasoline blends? Turns out he's working for an ethanol lobbying firm. You know,
hold on. Did you say he's working for an anti-ethanol or for an ethanol?
No, he's working for an ethanol lobbying
firm. Yeah, right.
You know, going to these debates and managing to get in and ask his questions. And that's just one example, one, you know, very Iowa-specific lobby. But something I think people need to be aware of when they're watching this process is just in many, many ways, it's very artificial. And in D.C. also, the extent to which you were asking initially about how many people in the Republican Party in D.C. are really anti-Trump, I think there is this artificial overrepresentation of the anti-Trump views. You know, among libertarians, you have an artificial representation of people who have more politically correct libertarian views, you know, as opposed to, let's say, you know, some of the Mises Institute people. So at every level, Jim, I think that the people who are in positions of power or who can have influence on the process, when you actually dig into it, it's clear that they don't really match what most Americans, certainly most, you know, conservative or libertarian Americans would say are their big issues.
Huh, interesting. Nathan, forgive me for bouncing around more here, but since you brought this up already, I'm just going to throw out a little story. My sister-in-law is a relatively famous scientist. I'm obviously not going to name her. But I'm taking a walk with her. We're just talking about stuff a few years ago. And I said to her, I said, can you tell me, I said, you know what I've heard is that, and she's a geneticist, so she would know about this. I said, I'm under the impression that ethanol takes more energy to make than it actually outputs. And is that true? And she said, well, yes, that's true. And I said, then why are we doing this? And she, her answer was really interesting. She said, well, Jim, here's the reason. She said, yes, you're right. From a purely scientific energy standpoint, it makes no sense. But she said, the reason we're doing this is to set up the template, to set up the infrastructure, so when we have something that actually does produce more output than input, than input, that we'll have the infrastructure in place to bring it to the marketplace. That's what she said, which I thought was really interesting. And you cover energy and environment, so I thought you might find. Do you have any comments on that at all, or especially being in Iowa? Do you think that's true, or?
I can't really say that's necessarily accurate or inaccurate, but it sounds a lot like what I've heard about people, you know, talking about making blue or green hydrogen viable on a large scale as a component of energy infrastructure. The notion, in part, of why that might be a system, at least that there's a lot of buy-in for, that you could realistically put in place, is that, you know, in terms of infrastructure, it might look a lot like the way that oil and, you know, oil products are transported. So, yeah, I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but, you know, the rate at which there's interesting stuff happening in energy, kind of beyond the flashy things, you know, like wind turbines, that sort of stuff, it really is pretty impressive. I just actually spoke with some people with a company called Nano Nuclear.
I was going to ask you about that. You wrote an article about it, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Nano Nuclear, yeah, they're a small company. They are one of many, along with Westinghouse, you know, Mitsubishi in Japan. Lots and lots of companies are working on these things called microreactors, which put out up to about 20 megawatts of electricity, or they can also provide potentially heat, you know, thermal energy for industrial processes. That's smaller than, you might have heard this term, small modular reactor.
Yes,
that's up to like, you know, maybe 200, 300 megawatts. And above that, above the small modular reactor, you have like a conventional nuclear plant.
Right.
So microreactors are maybe as small as like a thousandth the size of a conventional nuclear plant, which in addition to making them, you know, less dangerous in the event of something bad happening, they are small enough, or they could be small enough once they're at the commercial stage, to be shipped off to, for example, mining operations, which is what Nano is focused on. They, you know, I spoke with some people at an energy conference in Alaska last year who were attempting to develop these with the aim of putting them in some of those very remote Inuit and other, you know, indigenous Alaskan communities, places that are just far from any road, where the only other alternative would be something like diesel. And of course, you know, diesel is the price is not always that predictable.
I have to ask you here. This wasn't in your article. How long does the fuel in these things last? And they're about the size of a large truck, right?
So yeah, they're large enough. It depends upon the particular type of reactor, but yeah, generally they're the size where you can put them in a shipping, like an intermodal shipping container, and ship them to wherever. So you could have plausibly fuel, and let me qualify this also by saying you don't ship the fuel with the actual reactor.
Right, I understand.
You could have, like 10 years maybe, or possibly more of fuel. Which,
again,
if you're up in like, you know, very remote Alaska, or, you know, working in some mine in Canada, South Africa, wherever, you know, that can be a big advantage price-wise. But of course, you have to actually get these models to the point where they're easy enough to make, where the capital costs that would go in with at least the initial ones go way down. But that could happen plausibly in the next 10 years or so.
Does this company say how much these things would cost?
That's a good question. I didn't get any price information off of them.
Do you have any idea, like a ballpark figure? Are we talking about $1 million for each one, or do you know?
I think once they're at the point of commercialization, the price would drop below that. But honestly, I've not studied the pricing closely enough to be able to say definitively.
Now, I've always had friends ask me, I don't know as much about this as you, that's why I'm throwing this out. Why, like a friend asked me, why can't I have a tiny little reactor, nuclear reactor, driving my electric car? Now, what I've always said in the past, and you tell me if I'm wrong, is that because the shielding for that tiny little reactor would be so heavy, it wouldn't be worth it putting in the vehicle. Is that, do you know anything about this, or has anybody tried this, or?
Yeah, my understanding is that maybe not in the context of like a passenger car, but I think there has been work on, I think it might have been an airplane that was powered by a reactor like this or something else small. And part of the issue was, as you said, I think the shielding, but also managing waste. If you have a system that is not adequately protective, you could be, you know, dispersing radioactive waste, which is not a good thing.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think with, certainly with a lot of the newest reactor designs, they have, they're often designed in such a way as to remove as many moving parts as possible. They,
yeah.
they have inherent safety features. Basically, once it hits a certain threshold of, I believe, temperature or possibly some other factor, they'll just automatically stop working.
Right.
So, but yeah, to your point, I mean, that doesn't seem inherently impossible. On the other hand, it's still very, very difficult to do anything at the consumer scale with nuclear power. I don't know of anything really that we can speak of, except I think I might be mistaken, but I think there's a very small amount of radium or some other radioactive element in smoke detectors. And that's, yeah, let me look that up. I want to make sure I'm not misinforming people here.
That it's your job not to misinform people. It's my job to misinform people. That's what I do.
Yes. Well, there you go. I was going to say, I don't talk about conspiracy theorists. I talk about conspiracy realists. So it's actually not radium. It's americium.
Ah.
So the alpha particles from the americium source, they ionize air molecules, which makes some of them positively charged, some negatively charged. But yeah, pretty much anything radioactive, it's hard to get into consumer electronics or anything like that.
So I'm bouncing around some more here. You wrote an article speaking of all this stuff about John Kerry, who actually has come out now. Do you know who Patrick Moore is?
The Greenpeace guy, yeah.
Yeah, so I had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. And you know, he's lamenting about the fact that how come all these people who, you know, he's basically a climate change denier, basically. I mean, that's a very long subject for me to just wrap up in such short words. But his thing is, how come no one on the environmental side has embraced nuclear power? He said, I asked him point blank, what was your biggest regret being in Greenpeace? And he said that we rejected nuclear power. And so it appears, according to your article that was in the Epoch Times, that Kerry has now basically embraced this. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, if you've been paying attention, you have people who in the past, certainly when they were young, I think in the context of New England nuclear, Kerry was not exactly a zealous advocate of some of what they've done. But you have this shift, and part of it might be driven by, for example, Bill Gates is one of the big people behind some of this push for nuclear. He's been an investor in, I believe it's TerraPower, which is at work in Wyoming, developing a small modular reactor. So you do have, you know, a lot of influential people who have changed their minds on it. But yeah, broadly speaking, you're having people who, for whatever reason, if their concern is with carbon emissions, and in the case of environmentalists, if like a lot of people who either, you know, don't see climate change as a big issue or who don't see it as accurate in the way that it's presented to us, you know, those people might say, regardless of all that, nuclear is just this great energy source, not just power, but also energy for, you know, industrial processes, all sorts of things.
Right.
That has been kind of hamstrung for many decades. We haven't really been able to build a plant or even easily build a new reactor without it taking a long time. But it just seems to be, it has for a long time been this great option available that can help to, you know, you never get rid of scarcity, but you can at least ameliorate scarcity. Nuclear fission, I should say, not nuclear fusion, is like an actionable option in the toolkit that we can even look at other countries that just go ahead and approve nuclear fission faster. And some of them are doing it on the basis of, you know, climate change, trying to reduce carbon emissions, that sort of thing.
Well, Moore's point is that, and he's, you know, he said this even about himself, is that as 50 years ago, this was a very, very scary thing. These plants were going to melt down, China syndrome, all that rot. And now after 50 years of running them, with one or two exceptions, they've been unbelievably safe. And now that we know the current science is, we know not how to design them now. So even if they fail, they're not going to really hurt anybody. You know, there's that too. So, and you brought this up, so now I got to bring this up. You opened the door. So my impression is that we're probably 50 years or so away from actual commercial nuclear fusion. Do you think that's true?
You know, I am very hesitant to offer any sort of timescale. I know there's been excitement about fusion for decades. The joke as you've probably heard many times, is that nuclear fusion is always 25 years away.
So yeah, that's the problem, right?
Iteration of time away. So I make this point often. The most recent fusion experiment that was able to reach ignition at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, the fusion research that goes on there goes on in part because it's a component of nuclear weapons testing.
Uh-huh.
And so there's always, you know, given you know, American defense demand, given the way that we have, you know, resolved issues around nuclear proliferation and testing through treaties, there's always going to be some demand for this kind of work. You know, if in my frank opinion, I think it's, I'm going to choose my words carefully here. I think that it's not as though nuclear fusion is impossible, but I think it's remarkably convenient that this thing that is used in weapons testing can also be justified by appeals to energy. When that first announcement came, I actually was there for a press conference where Jennifer Granholm, the energy secretary, came up and said, this is in line, this can perhaps further the Biden administration goal of achieving commercial fusion within 10 years, which, you know, everyone that I've talked to, even people working closer to fusion, they don't see that as at all.
No, they don't. Matter of fact, I when I said 50 years, that's the earliest I've ever heard, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, it's unfortunately, and given the fact that we have nuclear fission, we have, gosh, even for some places, geothermal power, we have lots of options, obviously conventional oil, gas, coal, which has gotten a lot cleaner. We have so many options dangling fusion in front of people when it's not yet an option, when it might not be an option in my lifetime, my children's, I don't have kids yet, but, you know, God willing, my children's lifetime.
Yeah.
That's not to say that it's not worthwhile, but like, if we're talking about solving energy challenges today in the near term, and we're using the word nuclear, you know, we have an entire, not just one, but two generations of nuclear reactors, Gen 3 and Gen 4, that exist, but basically, you know, moving forward with them in the United States up until now has effectively been an impossibility. You know, if you want to make things happen now, how about, you know, trying to further that.
And right.
To the credit of the Congress and even the Biden administration, there's been, you know, for example, the Advance Act is something that nuclear people, as part of the National Defense Authorization Act passed in the summer, people in the nuclear industry are excited about that, including the nano people I spoke with, because it incentivizes some moves by the the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to kind of remove some of those hurdles. On the other hand, I mentioned this in the article, but there was a recent Government Accountability Office report on the NRC, which has supposedly been making these moves in the direction of liberalizing regulation, making it easier to actually do things. And the report points out that the NRC is still, from the position of some of the anonymous developers that they spoke with, making it very difficult. For example, having an unwritten rule about consulting with them that some developers, and whenever I hear about regulations, I worry about regulatory capture and people playing favorites. Some developers apparently were concerned that this was, you know, there were elements of the process that were not transparent. And so I just always wonder, are the insiders taking advantage of this? And if so, how are they doing so?
Okay, so did you think that that Kerry coming out and talking about this, I look at it as kind of maybe a door opening, you know? It's like, did you look at it that way or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's good to see. You know, if you're someone who's generally pro-nuclear. On the other hand, I do, I think, you know, you look at the overall trajectory of energy policy in this administration, and it can be a little difficult to know exactly how quickly some of the barriers that seem to exist for nuclear, for various other energy sources can be scaled back, whether there's a sense in which, you know, the government is so large and you have so many intersecting parts of it, the federal government, I mean, that you can, for example, have this statement from Kerry, who's, you know, to be clear, he's not like an energy department person. He's the climate czar,
right?
Which is this, you know, ill-defined, not Senate confirmed.
Right. Yeah. What is that? What is a climate czar? Yeah, exactly. And what does he do? Flies around the world and gives speeches, I guess. I don't know.
Well, not just give speeches, but apparently he engages in diplomacy with China, among other countries, and it's somewhat difficult to understand what he's talking about, how it aligns with other elements of American foreign policy. There's a lot of stuff happening with the climate change czar a climate czar role that just it raises your eyebrow, even if you think climate change is a serious issue that we need to address. Just the way that it's constituted structurally in relation to the executive branch, in relation to Congress, it's just kind of strange, hard to understand how it fits in with a constitutional system.
Well,
if you agree with the objective.
I'm not going to ask you to comment on this at all, but I also think he's one of the stupidest people in Washington, too. There's that also. So it's like you got a really stupid guy talking about science shit, and it's like it does not look good. That's my opinion, and you don't have to comment at all. I'm not gonna make it.
All I'm gonna say is that there are congressmen who are Democrats who I think could speak more eloquently. I've heard them. I believe his last name is Peters. He's like a scientist, trained physicist who I think was with Argonne or with Fermilab in Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And they don't have him out there talking about this. They have John Kerry.
Yes. You're a funny man. Holy shit. That's very true. Very true. All right. Let's get back to Iowa. So you heard Trump speak twice. So like, and you kind of alluded to this. What's the mood in the room generally? You know, I mean,
with Trump specifically, or just
yeah, with Trump specifically. Let's start with that.
So I have to say, I began this particular set of rallies. I was in Waterloo, Iowa, which is, you know, this it's not a tiny town, but not a huge town. It's the sort of place where Trump has his rallies. These are like mid-sized, you know, industrial cities in the Midwest or in the South or wherever else. You go there and there's this line snaking for there must have been about 1,000 or more people on fairly short notice here. You know, I go through, and obviously you have people hawking the MAGA merch. You have the kind of carnivalesque side, but really just talking to people, you get the sense that there's, you know, even from ones who are not huge Trump fans, and there are people there who are just like, I've come here to listen to him as a candidate. I haven't decided, you know, in Iowa, that's a good place for that because you, as a caucusing Iowan, you can actually decide these things. You actually have a voice as compared to some other states, but you have people who just say things were better for me under Trump. You know, the economy was better. Gas prices, inflation, all that. It wasn't crimping me. Seems like the border was better. People speaking in a pretty straightforward way about how they think that Trump was the better president. It's a very, you know, you get a lot of enthusiasm with him. You don't get with any of the other candidates. But on the whole, you just have a lot of conversations with people. You kind of shake your, you know, nod your head, you know, and like think, okay, that's sounds pretty reasonable to me, especially if you're speaking for yourself and not just kind of.
Was the thing in Waterloo, was that the thing at the Cattlemen's Association?
Yes.
So this wasn't really an actual like campaign rally per se, right? He was giving a speech, correct?
So this was a campaign. So I want to be very careful again. This was an event. In conjunction with Donald Trump making the case for himself as president. I'll just put it that way because
right.
I, you know, want to make sure I'm not misrepresenting it. And then, you know, just a few hours later, he goes up to Cedar Rapids, or rather goes south to Cedar Rapids, which is another, you know, mid-sized city, delivers a speech in a hotel room, hits fairly similar themes. But again, you have a, you know, massive crowd. You have a lot of enthusiasm along with people who are not all, you know, Trump, not all convinced to vote for Trump, but they're there and they're listening to him, kind of hearing out what he has to say.
What kind of, what did you see about Vivek regarding the crowds and enthusiasm and that sort of thing?
So that's a very, it's a good question. His event was something called Vectoberfest.
Okay. Alrighty.
Yeah. I mean, I
let's get the PR people involved. Come up with something.
look the word up. Look up Vectoberfest. There's a V-shaped sausage on a fork. So, Vivek has a real way of getting attention and doing. He's very creative. I'm going to say that. And his PR team, for example, he ends this with a big drone show where he's got, you know, drones depicting Revolutionary War soldiers banging away on drums.
God bless him. That's fantastic. I'd go just to see that.
and he also had free food and free beer. So I go in there. I don't want to, you know, some of the younger people, I think there were, you know, Vivek fans there, but I think also the word about free food, free beer might have also gotten out there. And hey, you know, more power to them. It's a little carnival-esque, but that's just American politics, right?
Free food is the magic words in all America. I mean, you do that, you say you're golden, you know, shit. You know, it doesn't matter what. And who else did you see there?
So I saw DeSantis. I saw him at a church in Cedar Rapids. And I saw Nikki Haley just yesterday up in a little town, a little farmhouse north of a town called Boone, north of Des Moines.
At one of those two speeches you saw Trump at, was that where he predicted that DeSantis is going to drop out? Did he mention that?
He might have alluded to it, but if he did, I don't think I had it in my
notes. He's explicitly said it now in the last 24 hours. I don't know if it was on Twitter. Go ahead.
His campaign has been sending out, I forget their exact phrasing, but they're calling it like Countdown to Armageddon or something, where they point out that DeSantis' team made some prediction that's dated to like 14 days from now about DeSantis. It's either DeSantis locking it in or Trump drop something to this effect that hasn't happened, and they're just counting down. So yes, clearly it's kind of this is a PR point that the campaign is working. They're kind of milking it, and you know, more power to them, because again, I'm going to be diplomatic here. I know a lot of people who are DeSantis fans or who work with DeSantis, but it has been really something to see a lot of momentum slip away over the past few months. It's hard for me to think of any one thing you can blame it on, aside from maybe just the fact that he is very good in his lane as the governor of Florida for people who agree with DeSantis. On the campaign trail, he has a way of being upstaged and easily memed, especially when you're dealing with America's, I'll call him America's funniest bully, somewhat affectionately, Donald Trump. If you're up against him and there's anything that you do that makes yourself vulnerable to that, he is going to take advantage of it.
It does seem that DeSantis, I mean, and this is why I want to ask you about this, because you've actually been in a room with him. I haven't. But on television, coming across the television screen, he doesn't exude a lot of charisma. I mean, personally, he doesn't.
No.
I mean, I
would say, I'll put it to you this way. I saw him in Long Beach as part of that Republican debate tour. He was a donor who he was speaking with, who's, you know, concerned about the shipping being affected by these environmental laws, you know, really intense things that they're putting in California to basically phase out diesel trucks, the purchase of new trucks for the ports starting 3 months from now.
Uh-huh.
That's going to be a, you know, huge law affecting a lot of people there. But DeSantis gets up on stage. He's got these, you know, workers behind him arrayed in their colorful vests. And I was taking photos, and I was not trying to take a photo that would look bad for DeSantis. I'm trying to just document it neutrally, but there's so much blank space around him that every Trump fan can say, oh, look at the crowds. Look at all the people who've come out for DeSantis.
Yeah.
So you can always make the joke. In Des Moines, or I should say in Cedar Rapids, this church, the campaign did a much better job. They put him in a small room. You know, there were probably a few hundred people there, but it felt crowded. It felt like there was a lot more energy. He was able to speak. He was able to speak about issues that he can comment more strongly on. A lot of people there, for example, they were very happy about what he said about education. Generally, it seems like managing the image of DeSantis has been a bit of a challenge, but he has also had the spotlight on him in a way that I think he hasn't before, and it's taken adjustment just to get to the point where he's not creating these images that can be easily shared and memed by his political opponents.
You know, I just thought of this just now. Do you think maybe they've played displaying his personality wrong? It does seem like people do respond to his seriousness. I mean, everyone agrees he's done a great job in Florida. And you tell me, you were there, but the general consensus of that snooze fest of the debate 2 weeks ago is that he won, from what I understand, what the polling said. And he didn't actually come off as any sort of great charismatic individual then, but he made his points. You know, it's very well, you know, it's obvious he can execute. He's done it, you know, as a governor. So do you think maybe they just played this whole thing wrong? Because I was going to ask you, you answered the question before I asked it, and that is, why did his campaign basically disintegrate? And I don't really know either. I can't figure it out.
I think there's a lot of things that he could have perhaps done differently. You talking about his personality, I made this point on another podcast with Davis Hunt. He runs the Pamphleteer out of Nashville, which is a great paper. All of your listeners should check it out, especially if they're in Nashville.
Is it called the Pamphleteer?
Pamphleteer, P-A-M-P-H-L-E-T-E-E-R. But what I said is that it seems as though, you know, he is kind of an alpha nerd or something like that. If that's that's what he could run with, is that, okay, you know, I'm not a cool guy. I'm not Donald Trump. I'm just a very different sort of person. But I, you know, I know the facts. I can execute. If he could lean into that, or if he had, maybe the trajectory would have been different. There's just something about putting Ron DeSantis in a pair of jeans and a blazer and a pair of, you know, long-toed cowboy boots.
The political consultants who do this shit should be shot. It's like, you know, it's like,
and you know, there's an entire committee of them, and there's not one person saying, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. No, it's like you got five different, 15 people probably sitting around a Formica conference room table voting on, okay, how are we going to do this? And so this very artificial, very DC, very beltway thing.
It's nuts.
And, yes, it, especially if you're running as a bit of an outsider, which DeSantis initially was doing. And now, of course, he's lost that perception in part because there is a lot of money behind him. And that's, you know, the most, I think, of any candidate ever, from what I understand, at this stage in an election like this. I think he's probably a non-entity at this point, as is every candidate other than Trump. But if he were to recover, I think it would probably rely on him leaning on his strengths and maybe being willing to not try to seem like the 2023 version of Paul Ryan, which is what a lot of people, they look at that and they just think, ugh, you know, that's not what I want. That's someone trying to seem really authentic, and it comes across as fake and false.
Well, okay, so we have a really interesting thing coming up here. This next election, assuming it's Biden and Trump, and I don't know if you caught this. I was talking before you came on about RFK throwing his head on the ring. I'm predicting right now that will cause Biden to lose. That's basically my prediction regardless. I mean, it is amazing to me how bad a job Biden has done, and the hatred for Trump is such that Trump is only a couple points ahead. But the point I was going to make is that either one of these guys, if they win, they're lame ducks on the very first day they're elected, both of them, because neither one of them can run for a second term, you know? So do you think DeSantis, I'm really looking ahead here, 4 years from now, do you think he has do you think he's setting this up to take another run? Do you think he could figure this out?
I think it's very possible DeSantis could be positioning himself that way. I mean, I spoke with at least one person in California when I asked about the prospect of Newsom running. That person said, well, probably, in my judgment, it's easier for him to sit out his term as governor, which I believe ends in 26, and then run in 28, because then he's not upsetting any apple carts. You know, sure, he'll have 2 years out of the national spotlight, but he'll probably find a way. He'll probably have the resources to keep on appearing on Fox News with Sean Hannity or whatever he's doing to get himself out there. And just from a pure political perspective, by the way, I think Newsom appearing on conservative media outlets, doing what he does, is a very smart move. I think it's him basically, I'm not sure how well it plays with Democrats, but I think it's a very interesting strategy, and it reflects the fact that he is, whether you like him or not, he's like a very good politician.
Yes.
In that respect. He's willing to, I don't think it's necessarily fair what he said about DeSantis saying, well, the fact that you agreed to this debate shows me that you're not serious, that you're not presidential, because I was just baiting you. And yet at the same time, that is kind of effective. That has a certain, it resonates with people. DeSantis, I would also look to Vivek in a few years, depending upon how everything shakes out. I think he has shown himself to be more serious and honestly more policy focused in terms of the kind of, you know, Trump-like lane when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to some of these cultural issues, honestly, in a way that one of the peculiar things about Trump that many people point out is, in substance, in terms of how he governed, he's actually far more to the center than a lot of the Republicans who, you know, or others who
are extremists. Very true.
He's a very heterodox candidate in the American system. He incorporates elements of, you know, conservatism and also kind of, you know, 90s Democratic Party points. But Vivek is not quite like that, but he's somewhat similar. He's kind of a post-libertarian who I think on some social issues, on life, on the border, He doesn't sound so libertarian, but in terms of his instincts on things like civil liberties and foreign policy, there's a lot of similarities to Trump, to Ron Paul, to some other people who have had resonance. It remains to be seen whether a guy like Ramaswamy could actually play well with like the broader American public. I've looked at his favorability rankings. His name is not that familiar. He has a somewhat high unfavorability ranking, but he's also gotten a lot of heat in the press, which I think is interesting and worth kind of noting.
Yeah.
You know, why does Ramaswamy, for example, seem to get a lot more heat in the press as opposed to a Nikki Haley or as opposed to Chris Christie or whoever else?
How many of these people, in your opinion, are doing this solely to set up for 28? I mean, right now it takes so long, if you're not already famous, it takes so long to get into the consciousness of the average American. I just assume Vivek is doing this to set up for 28. I don't think he's serious about the upcoming election at all. Do you think that's true, or I'm asking for your opinion and you don't have to give it because I love you?
Well, that's very sweet.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Stu Peters at night, it's a different experience.
Yes, I know. I know it is. I know.
I was going to say, I think Vivek, you know, I've been following his campaign pretty closely. You know, I know, for example, he's had over 100 events in Iowa. He's been pounding the pavement in New Hampshire, going on show after show after show. Yes, in a sense, he might be preparing for 2028, but like everybody who's running, he really imagines himself in the Oval Office. To subject yourself to this, you know, even people who you might not like politically, I'd say, you know, any Democrat, any Republican, any Libertarian, any Green Party person, whoever else, if you're actually going out there and you're really running that intensely, just as a matter of you as someone with an ego, you see yourself as president.
I suppose, honestly,
I would say, I look at a guy like Tim Scott and his campaign at this point, I see that as more of a strategic move to position himself in the future. I could see him maybe not running for president, but certainly positioning himself for future vice presidential bids. Although you could argue he is kind of, and I've spoken with people who really think that he has unfortunately kind of not defended Trump to the extent that you would want if you were trying to be his VP. But yeah. I look at a Tim Scott, I look at, he's not running this time, but Glenn Youngkin. I see them as people who are definitely gunning for 2028, maybe 2032. Some of the stranger people, I mean, strange, not in necessarily in a bad way. A Vivek Ramaswamy, for example, a more distinctive candidate like him, I think he really honestly believes he's going to be the president at the end of this cycle.
Oh, that's really interesting. I would say I believe that I think there's a distinct possibility he will be president someday. I don't know if it's going to be soon. But also the other thing I want to point out is I have predicted that assuming Trump wins the nomination, which seems increasingly likely, I think the prediction I've given is that I think he's going to pick Tim Scott as his VP, if only because for the same reason he picked Pence, and that is Scott is actually connected to Congress right now, and he needs somebody like that. But I don't know, you know, I've been wrong before. I was wrong once in 1972. I was in high school.
Who did you think was going to get the VP slot then in 72?
Oh, I don't know. Barry Goldwater? I have no idea.
That 64 speech made an impression, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, it did. Yeah, I know. What was that? What was it? Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. That was the quote, right? Yeah. See, it's still running, Nathan. It still works. But I do have to tell you that, Tulsi Gabbard has said recently that if Trump talked to her about it, she would seriously consider it. And I'm starting to, you know, I could see him going in that direction too. I could, you know.
Yeah, Tulsi would be a very interesting choice because I find it hard for my part to imagine that Tulsi would draw in many Democrats, many left-wing Democrats to a Trump ticket. On the other hand, a choice like that might deter people from voting for Biden or might draw in a certain percentage of independents who would not have otherwise shown up to vote, who would think, oh, you know, if I'm getting Trump plus some conventional Republican, it's just going to be business as usual. But if you have a Tulsi Gabbard, if it's kind of like the, you know, chaos candidate in a positive sense, hey, why not? You know, there's enough here on this plate that I could see my, it's an a la carte option that I could see myself actually going in and, you know, voting for.
That's a fascinating theory though, Nathan. I never thought of it as like a defensive move. That's really interesting. You have a point there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of Trump's strong suits, in addition to his verbal creativity, again, he's the funniest bully in America. And I don't say that in a,
no,
I'm
agree.
Not saying that in a moralistic way.
I agree.
He is willing to make interesting choices that, for example, his Freedom Cities idea and his platform, it's one of those things that you wonder why people haven't proposed something like it before, because it's something that the professional urbanists might be averse to saying, because there's something about the idea of using up all that land, all that federal land, that they might think this is, sacrosanct. On the other hand, he's talking about using BLM land, as I understand it, which you can already pretty much do anything you want with.
Yeah.
I look at that and then I think about, okay, what choices could Trump make in the coming weeks and months, aside from coming up with new nicknames for his enemies? And I honestly am looking forward to seeing what he does. Even if I don't like it, I'm sure it'll be entertaining.
I said this on a show a couple of days ago, and that is, for all Trump's strengths, and he always said that economics was his wheelhouse, and that seemed to be true, it's astonishing how good he was at foreign policy, considering the fact he'd never done anything like it before. But I think the reason is, you can tell me if you agree or not, I go back to Tina Fey and her autobiography, where she said sometimes it takes a bitch to get things done, sometimes it takes an asshole to get things done, you know? And I think, everyone say, oh my God, he's wreaking havoc on the world stage, all that sort of shit. No, he's scaring the shit out of our enemies. That's what he's doing, and it seemed to work.
He's scaring the shit out of our enemies. I think he's also, and I don't want to venture into territory that runs into, I don't want to go to theory cell here, too theoretical, but the notion of approaching things on the basis of making a deal, which I think really you listen to his rhetoric, and he's always trying to position himself in such a way as to allow someone else to present a counter offer that would get him to where he actually wanted to be in the first place, because he's always, overpromising.
When
he has ideas that sound ridiculous, but that when you think about it for a moment are pretty reasonable. Like, I'm going to say another one that doesn't sound so unreasonable, purchasing Greenland. But you look at Trump, you look at the way that he addresses these issues, I think that it's not as though he is amoral or anything, but I think he's more willing, maybe more able than a lot of people who've been brought up in the American international relations foreign policy schools, which in their various iterations, you have the people who are more Atlanticist, you have neoconservatives, you have people in various schools, but what they have in common is they're surrounded by oceans, they're on this, continent, able to dominate the world without really understanding it. And so they allow this excessive moralism to overtake their thinking. They're not as willing to recognize their own hypocrisy. They're not as willing to think clearly about American interests qua America. And I think that Trump, as much as he was scaring people, I think he was also able to step back and say, hey, maybe let's just not try to further these various crusades that we've been furthering for the past century. Now, that's a little, I don't know, tell me what you think about that, but that's what stands out to me. Less than scaring people, it's more just thinking in terms of interests and not getting quite so high up on your high horse on some of these issues.
No, what you said there made me think of a completely different question. And do not take this personally. I'm not addressing this to you, but you're talking about purchasing Greenland. And the thing that just occurred to me is that, do you think most people in your profession and the journalism profession are just too damn literal? They take things just too literally?
I think that one thing that I often tell people is that you listen to Trump in person and you understand that he's like the greatest stand-up comedian in America. And that's, I'm stealing that line from somebody else, by the way. I got to say, I didn't come up with
that. That's okay, though, because, yeah.
Listen to the patter, the stage patter, and also just there is real depth in terms of how he talks about these issues. And you understand, if you take these little words out of context, he's going to sound ridiculous, but that's because you didn't listen to the 2 minutes before, 2 minutes after, where it's obvious that he's setting this up. There's like a layer of irony. There's the interplay with the crowd. So when journalists, especially ones who are operating in bad faith, They take little selective snippets of what Trump says. Of course it's going to sound silly. Of course it's going to sound, you know, insane because you don't understand the context.
Yeah.
You know, people in my profession are so often fixated on providing the context that they want, which, I'm sure all of us have our biases. I try not to only provide the context that I want, but Trump has had a very, let me put it this way, the toughest crowd he's probably ever had is in the press row.
Oh, yeah.
And, that's worth thinking about. Because
he's pointing back there. Fake news.
Yeah.
Hey, Nathan, you stayed way longer than you were expecting to, so I hope I didn't overstay you. I hope. And also, go ahead.
I was going to say, I appreciated the compliments. I was just swayed.
I appreciate you doing this live, too, because I'm having a harder and harder time. People on the you're not on the East Coast right now, but people on the East Coast especially are, don't want to come on at 11:30 at night. So I really appreciate that, too. That you live in Chicago, right?
Yes. No, I almost wore my Chicago White Sox cap for this.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad about the Bears, but...
Yeah. I'm a little more of a Packers fan than anything else.
Oh, okay. All right. Well... Yeah.
But still.
You got it going on. Well, yeah, right. Hey, I hope we can do this again. I really appreciate it.
Definitely. Yeah. Great to be on, Jim.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I love having you. So you have a very unique, because of what you report on, you and also the mix of energy and politics is pretty cool. So it gives you a very distinct perspective, and I appreciate it. And I think the crowd does too. So thank you.
Well, it's a shame we couldn't get into energy and geopolitics and, what's happening with the Azeris and just all the chess pieces on the world stage. Because I think that's very important to understand when you're looking at American politics is how does this all intersect globally? How does that, something I think a lot of it's worth focusing on. But anyway, yes, thanks. Glad to be on as always. Yeah,
nice to see you. We'll talk soon. You take care, okay?
For sure.
You thanks. Too. That's Nathan Wooster of the Epoch Times. Fabulous guy, fantastic, very knowledgeable. And we got people on here who have these dual assignments. Like he has energy and politics. Jazz Shaw has politics and UFOs, stuff like that. I love these people. They have a duality, and that duality makes them think different ways. Stuff we never think of before. Also, by the way, I want to point this out. If you noticed his little tag at the top of the screen, his name is pronounced Wooster, but it's spelled Worcester. It's a standard, English spelling, like Leicester, the suburb of London is actually spelled Leicester, that sort of thing. So I just want to point that out there. So give me a call if you want. Do you want to talk about what just happened? You want to talk about what was famous in your life or whatever? You want to tell me I look ugly at the age of 80 or 68? You can do that. JimAndKnight.com/call. You can't. I just realized you can't see my cursor, man. Yeah, right here. JimAndKnight.com/call. You can send us a text, voicemail, 408-458-5088. Best number in America, 408-458-5088. And yes, that is the area code for Silicon Valley. It is. So you can give me a call here if you want, next few minutes. I want to close with a couple of things here. We like to do the science news or the paranormal shit at the end is what we like to do. But there were two things in the science news the last couple of days. I thought you'd find this kind of interesting. Scientists are reporting that energetic outbursts from outer space are infecting weather phenomena and also the planet's magnetic field, which is causing a lot of animals, birds especially, to fly off course when they're migrating. And apparently this is being caused by electromagnetic bursts from the sun, but these bursts are, and you've probably heard this before, talking about what Nathan was talking about, if we're talking about nuclear shit, if a nuclear bomb goes off, or if there's a major, I don't think that would happen. You need a nuclear bomb to do that. An electromagnetic pulse gets sent out, and it can fry or at least disable your cell phone, all computers, everything. I mean, it's been theorized for a long time that if a solar flare on the sun was large enough, it could literally take out all the electronics in the United States. Maybe just temporarily, maybe for a few minutes or a few hours, but still it could completely shut everything down. Now, supposedly around 200-300 years ago, there was a flare that big. Of course, there were no electronics then, you know, so that's no one. And, you know, that gets to another thing about climate change. You know, Patrick Moore, our distinguished guest a couple of weeks ago, he said this. He said, yeah, and nobody is arguing this point. The world is warming up. Nobody's arguing that. I don't know a single scientist that disputes that. Patrick says the world climate overall, of course, you know, the thing is it's an average because the temperature fluctuates more toward the equator than at the poles. But basically, in the last 300 years, the heat of the Earth has gone up 1 degree Celsius, about 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit, so far in the last 300 years. But he also points out that there was no industrialization for at least half that time. And that's the same thing with the solar flare. Yeah, the solar flare happened, like, I can't remember what it was, 300 years ago? Of course, there were no electronics. Nothing happened. But if it happened now, you know, we could be in deep doo-doo, at least for a little while. If not, no one really knows how the long-term effects of that would be, but it would probably knock out every single electronic computerized device in the entire U.S. That could happen. So the birds now, you got birds and what the other animals, let me see, I think like penguins or something. Oh, they're birds. Yeah, Jim, you're smart. So the thing is they're getting screwed up by the fact that this is happening. So I thought you'd find that interesting. And the second thing I have here, and this is more weird. Now, you've probably heard this, and I've talked about this a couple of times, about the fact that there's a bunch of scientists who think there's a good possibility. As a matter of fact, I don't understand how they came up with this figure, but apparently they had some formula that justified it, that I've heard there's a 20% chance that our entire universe or everything you know is a simulation in somebody else's computer, that's the case. Okay, I don't know how they came up with 20%, but people have been talking about it for a long time. Basically, it's like The Matrix, right? Okay, so if you've seen that movie. So what happened recently, a new law of physics and now points to evidence we're living in a simulated universe. So this guy, his name is, he's at the University of Portsmouth. Oh my God, I did not copy his name here. I think it's Vostek or something like that. Vopson, that's what it is. He's a professor Vopson at the University of Portsmouth. So he's come up with a theory of information entropy, basically. Now, entropy is the idea of systems slowly devolving into chaos. The second theory of thermodynamics says that anything that has heat, eventually the entropy of the atoms basically increase it. It will either increase or stay the same, but will not decrease. That's what that theory is. Okay, you following me? I'm going to read this just so that you get the point. I'm not confusing you. The second law of thermodynamics holds that systems spontaneously evolve towards states of higher entropy. The quantity often viewed as representing the amount of randomness or disorder in a system. Now, according to this law, entropy can only increase or stay the same and never reduce. So, information entropy, and that's part of what's called information physics. That's the theory. The general theory is that the entire universe is created by bits of information. In other words, all matter is actually information. That's the theory there. So Vopson came up with this theory of information entropy, but when testing it, he came to the realization that, I'll read this some more. Originally, Vopson also anticipated that the entropy within the information systems would similarly decrease. However, to his surprise, he says the recent observations appear to show just the opposite, leading him to establish what he calls the second law of information dynamics. So in other words, it's opposite of traditional Newtonian physics. And he thinks they will be able to use this to find evidence of the fact that, our universe is constructed by another being. Yeah, so you're not real. And I'm not real either. Of course, I'm a guy on your internet TV screen, you know, but yeah. So I'm a Max Headroom or something, I don't know. But yeah, that's the theory. God heaven, God help us. Who knows what's going on. All right, you're not calling? It's my birthday. Fuck you. So I'm going. Now, tomorrow night, we got Jeff Meyer coming on. He's from Conk News. He's going to talk about it. I know he'll have some stuff. I have some thoughts about the war in Israel going on that I did not want to do tonight because I knew Nathan was going to come on early. And Thursday, I'm taking off. I'm going to the UP in Michigan. I'm going to have fun. Walk around for a few days. And we'll be back on Monday. On Monday, our guest is John Miller. He's the guy who wrote the book about the start of American football in the United States. It's fascinating because it involves politics, presidential politics, all sorts of shit. Not to mention the fact this is really amazing. Okay, football started in the United States around 1894. I think Princeton versus Rutgers was the very first football game of any kind, collegiate or anything. Okay, so 6 years later, from 1900 to 1905, over 160 players were killed playing in football games in the United States. Yeah, they were actually killed on the football field. They died on the football field, 160 of them in 5 years. And Teddy Roosevelt comes along. He's the president of that time. He says, you guys got to fix this or else we're going to have to shut this down. And the reaction to that and what happened is really, is a really fascinating story. So anyway, John Miller's going to talk to us about that next Tuesday, a week from tonight. The King brothers are coming on. They're in their 20s. They started a talk show in their garage in Palo Alto, California, that actually, like, drew people. They're on the internet, and they put out chairs, and the next thing you know, they got, like, 100 people showing up. So, for every show. It's going to be interesting talking to them, too. That should be really fascinating. You know, I like to talk to the fascinating people here. That's really cool. I got to thank Nathan. This is not the first time I've talked to Nathan. It's the first time I've talked to him on video. He always has something interesting to say. So thank you to him. I want to thank you for watching. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you wherever you are. And I will see you tomorrow night. Here's the end card.